What I'm going to do today is to tell you about some work that's very much in progress, rather than tell you something that is completed. And the reason I'm doing this is to, with the hope that I'm sure many of you will have some feedback for me and even maybe some interesting new ideas. Okay, so most of my lab is interested in general in understanding how cells sense and respond to changes in their extracellular environment. And for a number of years, we've focused on studying how cells respond to deprivation for nutrients. Okay, and so what I'm going to talk to you about is our studies of one of these nutrient homeostatic networks or systems, where we've done a lot of biology and are now starting to do some more systems level work. Okay, so what I'll do in the first part of the talk is to give you some necessary background and mechanistic information. And by mechanistic information, I just mean regular biology that has come mostly from studies in my lab in the past 10 years now. And this information, though, is really, I think, necessary to understand not just the context, but the interpretation of what I'm going to tell you in the second part of the talk, which is our more recent forays into this more systems-level analysis of nutrient homeostasis. And in particular, I'm going to focus on telling you two short stories about biostability and hysteresis in the system and about buffering. So by way of introduction, nutrients and ions are, of course, essential for essentially all cellular processes, and many of them are actually toxic when present in excess quantities. This is particularly true of a number of metals. We study nutrient homeostasis, before I forget to tell you, in budding yeast. And so what I mean by nutrient homeostasis is that for many nutrients and ions, the cells maintain these nutrients and ions within a relatively narrow concentration range intracellularly, despite the fact that these things fluctuate in a dynamic and unpredictable manner in the environment. So in general, the strategies that the cells employ to maintain nutrients and ions within a narrow concentration range are to modulate the uptake of these things from the extracellular environment, to control the rate of usage of nutrients and ions by, for example, modulating growth rate, and finally, the cells for many of the nutrients and ions can store excess quantities of these things, which can then be mobilized in times of need. Yeah, so this is a really important issue about which there's little data. So for what I'm going to talk to you about in organic phosphate, there have been measurements made by NMR spectroscopy, just using monitoring natural abundance P31. And there it is really the nutrients present in high levels in the cytoplasm, millimolar range, and maintained in a range that fluctuates not more than twofold. Now, for others, it's not really known because these things are very hard to measure in living cells. But the one thing I can tell you, the other example where I'm not going to talk about, but where we're doing some work is the network that's involved in the response to zinc. And there, the cells can grow at an optimal growth rate in concentrations now of extracellular zinc that differ by 8 orders of magnitude. Okay, so I strongly suspect that the internal concentration's not fluctuating like that. So we don't know, and this is really an important point, and a lot of work needs to be done developing better reporters to monitor these things. It's just technically, it's really a demanding thing. pH? Yeah, but yes, there are good measurements, and one can, of course, use pH-sensitive fluorescent proteins to monitor pH within cells, sure. And most of the work that I know about in eukaryotic cells has been done in the secretory compartments. Yeah, using those pH-sensitive GFPs. Okay, yes, that's an important question. Okay, so as I mentioned, we've been studying this network that's involved in the cell's ability to sense and respond to levels of inorganic phosphate. And just to remind you, it's obviously important for the synthesis of a number of nucleotides, phospholipids, and the cells go through great pains to maintain, I think, reasonably high constant levels of free inorganic phosphate. So that these processes, which are phosphate intensive, can proceed in a manner that doesn't perturb cell growth or the cell cycle. And of course, this can't be made. It's got to be obtained from the environment. Okay, so when cells are limited for phosphate, they have three major classes of response. They increase the uptake of phosphate across the plasma membrane, and I'll tell you this is by modulating the amount of transporter on the membrane, and I'll tell you in detail what we know about how this works. As I mentioned, phosphate can be stored intracellularly in the yeast vacuole, which I haven't drawn schematically here, and so in response to starvation, these stores can be mobilized. And under conditions where the cells are grown in phosphate-replete medium, those internal stores can account for up to 30% of the dry weight of the yeast cell. So, huge amount of stores. And finally, the cells upregulate production of nonspecific phosphatases in response to phosphate limitation. And clearly, all of these things are an effort to maintain or restore intracellular phosphate levels. And I should say that all three of these responses are mediated largely at the level of gene regulation or transcriptional control. And so there exists, and I'm going to tell you about next, a pathway within the cell or network that allows the cells to sense inorganic phosphate levels and then transduce this signal to the nucleus to affect changes in gene expression. Okay, so the network of proteins involved in this sensing and signal transduction was identified long before I ever started working on this problem in the 70s by Yasuji Oshima's group in Japan. And they identified these in a manner exactly as we were talking about before in Roy's talk, where these were just identified as mutations which caused defects in the expression of this gene, FO5, which codes for a secreted phosphatase that's involved in scavenging phosphate. This is easily assayed on whole cells, and so people a long time ago did a screen and identified these mutants. And the details here don't matter too much, but I just want to, in the first part of the talk, tell you what we know about this part of the signaling pathway, which includes two transcription factors, FO2 and FO4. These two control expression of all of the genes, and we know all of them, of course, from microarray analysis, that are whose transcription is upregulated in response to phosphate limitation. So the activity of one of them, FO4, is regulated in response to phosphate availability by a protein kinase that's a member of this cyclin CDK family. And the activity of this kinase, in turn, is regulated by a CDK inhibitor called FO81. And finally, at the top of the pathway here is an inorganic phosphate transporter. And I'll have much, much more to say about this transporter. And there's actually a lot of feedback in the system in the sense that the transporter, production of the transporter, is upregulated by this transcription factor in response to phosphate limitation. Okay, but we don't need to worry about that detail right now. What I want to focus on is just reviewing what we know mechanistically about how this protein kinase controls the activity of this transcription factor, FO4, to then control expression of the phosphate responsive genes and this whole phosphate starvation response. Okay, so as I mentioned, the activity of this kinase, FO80, FO85, which has these two subunits, is regulated in response to extracellular phosphate availability. So when cells are grown in high phosphate, the kinase is active, and it phosphorylates and inactivates this transcription factor, FO4. Okay, and this leads to lack of expression of the phosphate responsive genes. And again, this makes sense because the cells don't need to express those genes when there's plenty of phosphate around. And then in response to phosphate starvation, I told you the activity of this kinase is regulated by that CDK inhibitor, and I won't say much more about the inhibitor, but it inactivates the kinase, and this leads to accumulation of the transcription factor FO4 in this unphosphorylated form, and it's this form that turns on expression of the 40 or so phosphate responsive genes. Okay, so we know a tremendous amount about how phosphorylation controls the activity of this transcription factor, and in the next few slides I just want to review that for you, because as I said, it sort of sets the stage for the new stuff I want to tell you about in the second part of this talk. Okay, yeah? Okay, so in response to deprivation for any essential nutrients, the cells arrest in G1 and essentially enter stationary phase. Now, but this is an important point, yeah, that I didn't say anything about, but the time scale for that is much longer for block of the cell cycle and entry into stationary phase is longer than the time scale for the response I'm going to tell you about. Yeah. So and specifically, cells that have been previously grown in phosphate-rich medium, so when they have plenty of nutrient, if we then transfer them to medium that completely lacks inorganic phosphate, they have enough internal stores to divide for on the order of, to complete three more cell cycles. Yeah. And doubling time here is 90-100 minutes. Okay. Okay, so regulation of FO4. So it turns out the regulation of this transcription factor is complex, and one way in which its activity is controlled is by control of its subcellular localization. So I told you when cells are grown in high phosphate, it's phosphorylated, and when they're starved, it's not. And we can easily monitor localization of FO4 with a functional FO4 GFP fusion, which we did a long time ago. And it turns out that the phosphorylated form of FO4 is localized to the cytoplasm, and the unphosphorylated form is concentrated in the nucleus. And so we know a huge amount, actually, about how phosphorylation controls the subcellular localization of FO4. And it actually, so this is kind of an old, lousy picture, but if we look, and this I don't actually remember because this is some old slide I yanked up, but this was likely something, an analysis we did with this gene expressed from a low copy plasmid in a strain lacking FO4, but even that modest overexpression gets you some FO4 in the nucleus. With a wild type cell, like analyzed by spinning disc confocal, it's largely excluded from the nucleus. Yeah. It's probably not, but I will say, it is not all or none, and we know from some photobleaching experiments, the protein's rapidly shuttling between the two compartments. Pardon? Oh, in this experiment? No, this is just 5-phosphate outside the cell conditions. Absolutely. We take cells grown in high phosphate, you know, image them. It's largely cytoplasmic. Shift to no phosphate or low phosphate. It doesn't matter. And the protein concentrates in the nucleus. Yes, yes. And I'm going to show you some data, but I'll just tell you now, the time scale for movement of the protein from the cytoplasm to the nucleus upon phosphate starvation is on the order of 10 minutes. And this is in part because it's that time scale is dependent on previous growth conditions because it's tied to polyphosphate utilization. Okay, the reverse, so I haven't told you, but if you take cells, starve for phosphate, and add phosphate back, in about 3 minutes, it's cytoplasmic again. So it's rapid relocalization. So in eukaryotic cells, this is certainly a very common mechanism used to control the activity of regulatory proteins. Yeah, and not surprising. I mean, the cells, you know, have this barrier between the nucleus and the cytoplasm, and they've exploited it for regulatory purposes. Not surprising. It is very common. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so, oh, right. So phosphorylation, we know a lot about how phosphorylation regulates this movement. Yeah, okay, so yeah, this will answer your question. So this is just obviously a cartoon summarizing what we know. So when FOFOR is not phosphorylated, so this is phosphate starvation conditions, it binds to a protein in the cytoplasm called an import receptor. The gene name doesn't matter here. But the bottom line is that this complex between the import receptor and FOFOR then translocates through the nuclear pore complex, this hole here that I haven't really diagrammed, to the nucleus where FOFOR is released. And really, the details here are quite well understood in the sense that, you know, it's understood how the import receptor knows which compartment it's in and things like this, but I don't want to get into all of that right now. So the important point is that unphosphorylated FOFOR is bound by this import receptor and carried into the nucleus, and once it's in there, there's an export receptor that is capable of carrying proteins in the reverse direction from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. But this protein will not recognize unphosphorylated FOFOR, or it recognizes it very inefficiently. So this leads to FOFOR accumulation in the nucleus, right? Because it's imported and is not exported. Okay, and then the reverse is true, in the sense that FOFOR is phosphorylated in phosphate-rich conditions. And under these conditions, phosphorylated FOFOR now in the nucleus can be recognized by the export receptor, carried to the cytoplasm, but once it's in the cytoplasm, it's not re-imported because this import receptor only very poorly recognizes the phosphorylated species. So, yeah, okay, so no, these proteins are, there are 13 of these so-called transportins in yeast cells. They're all conserved in mammalian cells, and the mammalian cells have a few extra ones. And no, they are not specific for FOFOR, actually. There are other cargo that have been identified for PSE1, which is the import receptor, and MSN5, which is the export receptor. Yeah. Yeah, and there's a whole little cottage industry understanding how the receptors recognize the cargos and select them appropriate ones. Okay, so phosphorylation regulates translocation in two ways. It promotes export and inhibits import, and this leads to appropriate regulation of FOFOR localization. Okay, so it turns out that, remarkably, this isn't the only way that phosphorylation controls FOFOR activity. I told you localization is one way, but it turns out that phosphorylation also regulates the binding of FOFOR to promoters within the nucleus. And the way in which this works is simple. When FOFOR is unphosphorylated, it binds cooperatively with that other transcription factor I told you about called FO2. And together, these proteins promote transcription of phosphate-responsive genes, all of them. But the target for regulation of this pathway is this one transcription factor, FO4. The other one, FO2, is constitutively nuclear and not phosphorylated by the kinase. Okay, so what happens when FOFOR is phosphorylated? You can guess it disrupts the interaction with FO2, and this also helps keep transcription of the phosphate-responsive genes off. Okay, so this is a lot of things for phosphorylation to be doing. You know, inhibiting import, promoting export, and inhibiting the interaction with its other protein, FO2. So we know a great deal about how phosphorylation can do all of those things. And that came from a series of studies where we mapped the sites of phosphorylation on the FO4 protein, diagrammed as this little line. And they're indicated here with the labels we use to denote the sites. SP just stands for serine proline. It's the consensus sequence recognized by these cyclin-dependent kinases. And at any rate, there are four sites of phosphorylation that we call 2, 3, 4, and 6. And I should emphasize that, so in high phosphate conditions, FO4 is fully phosphorylated on all four sites. And the modifications are all put on by that one kinase, FO8085. So in the absence of the kinase, FO4 is unphosphorylated. So there's no other kinase substitutes. Yes. So that's a very interesting issue, and that's exactly where I'm headed. And that's why I wanted to tell you this, even though it's kind of, I mean, it's stuff we did, you know, a small number of years ago. But that is used, those two mechanisms you're going to see are used to differentially regulate expression of the phosphate responsive genes in different conditions. Meaning, you know, I've told you the two extremes, like high phosphate, no phosphate, but there's some range in between. And what I'm going to show you is that in just two slides, in this intermediate range that we call intermediate phosphate, but just in between the two extremes, FO4 accumulates in a form that's partially phosphorylated and can activate transcription of only a subset of the genes. So it is used. Yeah? That is possible, yes, that it's shuttling. And in high phosphate, you need phosphorylation to keep the gene completely off. That's possible, yes. And in fact, that gene FO5 is really tightly repressed. And by that, I mean there are, even by reverse transcriptase, you know, RT-PCR, you can't detect transcript in high phosphate conditions. And that may be part of the reason why. Yeah, so FO4 is dephosphorylated by a phosphatase activity that is present in both the nucleus and the cytoplasm. I didn't tell you, and I should have, the kinase is exclusively nuclear. So the signal has to be communicated, you know, presumably from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. The identity of the phosphatase is likely this conserved phosphatase, it's protein phosphatase 1 encoded by the GLIC7 gene in yeast, but we haven't done much with that. Yeah, it is an important issue. It's been a much more difficult problem. That gene's essential, and it dephosphorylates a lot of proteins that are involved in other processes. Okay. So what I was going to tell you about, finish this up with, is how phosphorylation regulates all these things, you know, import, export, and FO2 interaction. And I just told you it's multiply phosphorylated, and it turns out, and this was, I think, a very surprising thing, it was certainly surprising to me, that these phosphorylation sites have distinct and completely separable roles in regulating FO4 activity. So what I mean by that is that phosphorylation of these two sites, 2 and 3, is necessary and sufficient to promote export from the nucleus by promoting binding to that export receptor. Similarly, phosphorylation of this one site, site 4, within the nuclear localization signal is necessary and sufficient to inhibit import by inhibiting association with the import receptor. And finally, phosphorylation of this single site, site 6, is necessary and sufficient to inhibit the interaction with FO2, that other transcription factor. Okay, and so right, exactly as was raised, I mean, we were wondering why the heck there are so multiple layers of regulation of this protein. And, That's where I'm going. Okay, so I'm not going to drag you through any of the real data, and I'll just tell you that we carried out basically a bunch of entomological studies and some modeling to try to understand exactly that. Is there an order or preference in phosphorylation of these different sites in vitro? So this is purified kinase and purified substrate, and we got a very striking result. So first, the kinase is partially processive. Each interaction it has with this substrate, on average, there are a couple of phosphates transferred to the substrate. But the most striking result was that the kinase had dramatic preference for phosphorylation of this one site, site 6, the one that regulates the interaction with FO2. Okay, and so what this predicted is that, well, we knew that in no phosphate conditions, the kinase isn't active. FO4, this plain line here, accumulates in the unphosphorylated form. And I already told you about high phosphate indicated by these red balls. It's fully phosphorylated. And what we speculated, and it turns out to be true, is that in some intermediate range of phosphate, so by intermediate, I just mean between experimentally accessible between what the no and high phosphate regimes are. It spans a couple, at least two orders of magnitude in phosphate concentration. And we predicted that under these conditions, when the kinase is partially active, the phosphatase is present, that FO4 might accumulate preferentially phosphorylated on site 6. And this turns out to be the case. The protein's partially phosphorylated. And this form, it turns out, can activate. Because site six is phosphorylated, it can activate transcription of some of the phosphate-responsive genes, like this gene FO84, and the name doesn't matter here, but suffice it to say that this partially phosphorylated form accumulates in the nucleus, because those sites that regulate transport aren't phosphorylated, but it's phosphorylated on site six, and this disrupts the interaction with FO2 and prevents it from activating transcription of FO5. That secreted phosphatase, but allows it to activate transcription of a number of other targets, which include FO84, the high affinity phosphate transporter. So the kinetic properties of the kinase, meaning this preference for phosphorylation of site 6, help generate what are two thresholds in this pathway. So in the high phosphate regime, the kinase is active and FO4 is fully phosphorylated, localized to the cytoplasm, but when phosphate levels drop into what I'm calling the intermediate regime, the kinase is partially inactivated. And the phosphatase is active. This leads to accumulation of a partially phosphorylated form, which we can confirm by a number of experimental methods. And then when phosphate drops further, the protein, the kinase is fully inactivated, and the FO4 is fully unphosphorylated and activates expression of all of the phosphate responsive genes. Yeah. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's clearly some kind of continuum. Yes. Yes. And this was just meant to be schematic. Absolutely. Okay. Okay, and so what this does for the cell, and we think why the cells bother to do this, is that in this intermediate phosphate range, I told you this gene, FO84, is transcribed, but not the phosphatase. And FO84 encodes the high affinity phosphate transporter, which is displayed on the plasma membrane under these conditions. And the Km of the transporter is such that overexpression or expression of FO84 under these conditions allows the cells to restore what must be some balance between uptake and usage. So restore what was presumably initially a decrease in intracellular phosphate levels. So this is an appropriate response in this concentration range and allows the cells to grow at the normal growth rate under these conditions. Okay, and only when things are terrible, meaning there's nothing to be gained, phosphate levels drop below the km for transport by this transporter, the high affinity transporter, then the cells presumably respond to a drop in intracellular inorganic phosphate, and they upregulate expression of all of the phosphate responsive genes, including this phosphatase Fo5. And I should mention that we have a lot of data that argues quite convincingly that phosphate is sensed intracellularly in the cytoplasm, that the cells are not sensing the extracellular levels. Okay, so enough of the background, and now what I want to do is to just turn to some more recent work we've done, as I said, trying to make sense out of this pathway at a higher level. So first I should back up and tell you that these nutrient-sensitive regulatory networks in yeast, one reason we became interested in this systems-level approach is that many of them, the ones listed here, although the proteins involved in sensing and responding to those nutrients and ions bear no homology to one another, it turns out that the architecture of the networks is remarkably similar. So specifically, they both have essentially two types of regulation, both of which are centered on regulating the abundance of the transporter for the nutrient at the plasma membrane. So what we think is going on in each of the systems is that the transporter is produced, and this is, of course, the means of entry of nutrient into the cell. So we think nutrient is likely sensed intracellularly by a pathway, which then modulates the expression of the transcription of the transporter. So there's feedback in the system. So high concentrations of nutrient repress transcription of the transporter. The transporters are also regulated post-translationally. They're internalized, they're downregulated by endocytosis in response to high concentrations of nutrient. And this is likely a response the cells have to prevent accumulation of excess toxic quantities of nutrient. Okay, so the striking thing to us was that each of the systems had this similar simple architecture, and indeed all six of these also have two additional features. That is the presence of low affinity transporters. So I told you in pink about Fo84, the high affinity transporter for phosphate, but it turns out that in each of the six instances I told you about previously, there are other transporters selective for the nutrient that are expressed on the plasma membrane and operate in a different concentration regime. Similarly, in those cases I described, the cells have an ability to store the nutrients intracellularly in a manner such that they can sequester excess quantities and can also mobilize these stores in response to need. Okay, so what we're... Iron. So that regulation is more complex, which is why we didn't put it on this list, because there's regulation at the level of translation as well in that system. Yeah. So these are control of the transporter is, as far as one knows, largely at the level of transcription. Yeah. So phosphate, we know, like I said, it's on the order of 2 to 3 cell cycles for phosphate, but for that nutrient, the demand is very high. You know, usage is incredibly high to power the cell cycle because of, presumably, its nucleotide biosynthesis. So for other nutrients like zinc, even more cell cycles can be completed in the absence of zinc. I'd say it's on the order of, depending again on the prior growth conditions, probably 5 cell cycles. It's a long time.
Do you think that all nutrients can, that cells
Yeah, so it depends on, so not all nutrients behave this way. So conspicuously absent are like carbon and nitrogen, which, so carbon can be stored. The cells have, you know, yeast have a storage carbohydrate glycogen that accumulates. But in cells grown, normal exponentially dividing cells, there's not much glycogen stored. That normally happens when cells enter stationary phase. So limitation for those nutrients causes much more rapid cell cycle arrest. Yeah. Yes, so not all of them are the same. Yeah. Okay, so what we're really interested in at this point, and I are certainly far from answering, is how that network structure that I showed you on the previous slide gives rise to this property of homeostasis, that is the ability to maintain nutrients in a reasonably narrow concentration range or to dampen fluctuations in the extracellular environment. And we'd like to know, for example, is the architecture that I showed you, the wiring diagram on the previous slide, is this sufficient to give rise to this property? And which aspects of the design are critical? And I think most interestingly in this case, is the same design or architecture really used for multiple nutrient homeostasis systems? Okay, so we've begun to characterize the properties of the system using a number of single cell reporters, basically fluorescent reporters, that allow us to monitor signaling in single living cells. And I'm just going to talk to you about our initial efforts to do this and a couple of interesting aspects or properties of the system we've uncovered by doing this. And again, this is very much a work in progress. Nothing's really complete here. Okay, right. So the strategy I just told you used these reporters to characterize the dynamic behavior of the system and the response, steady state responses to different phosphate concentrations, and then to develop some kind of computational model based on what we know about the structure and kept in line with these experimental measurements. Okay, so I told you I'm going to tell you about these two things, biostability and buffering. So first, biostability. So just to remind you, FO84 encodes this high affinity phosphate transporter whose expression is regulated by this transcription factor FO4. So again, there's feedback here in the expression of the high affinity transporter. And so, I should mention that, the way these genes were identified was by mutational analysis, looking for defects in expression of this phosphatase, so activation of the signaling pathway. And it turns out that loss of the high affinity phosphate transporter, even in phosphate replete conditions, leads to constitutive expression of this pathway, so constitutive signaling. So the cells behave as if they're starving for phosphate when you delete the high affinity transporter. And this has been known for a very long time, 30 years. And I have to say, ever since we started working on this, has been quite a puzzle because the Km for the transporter is on the order of 10 micromolar. But cells are grown in high phosphate conditions in 10 millimolar inorganic phosphate. And so we were really puzzled. Furthermore, I should say that in high phosphate conditions, there's very little of this inorganic, the high affinity transporter present on the plasma membrane. So this was kind of a bizarre observation that deletion of the transporter in these conditions, high phosphate conditions, where the transporter is barely present, makes the cells behave as if they're starving for phosphate. So totally bizarre. But the result is absolutely clear. And so what I'm going to tell you about biostability came from our efforts to understand the phenotype of cells lacking the transporter. And as you'll see, I think that it was it's certainly a little detective story carried out by a couple of students in my lab. Okay, so that's the issue. Why, when you delete the transporter that's barely there, do cells behave as if they're starving? And I mentioned this before, but I just want to reinforce it, that the cells have two ways to get phosphate into inside. One is through Fo84, the blue arrow, and it turns out that there are four low-affinity phosphate transporters that we identified through some genetics that I won't talk about. And so both of these systems presumably participate in bringing phosphate into the cell. And based on the kinetic properties of the transporters, when we identified these low-affinity ones, we thought these would be the ones that would be relevant in high phosphate conditions for bringing phosphate into the cell. And again, this made us wonder even more why, when you delete the high affinity transporters, do the cells behave as if they're starving if the major transport capacity under these conditions is carried out by the low affinity system. So this was totally bizarre. And we spent 10 years, I'd say, with this conundrum and had no idea what was going on. And I think now we have quite a good idea of what's happening. And that's what I'm going to tell you about first. Okay, and so I'll just tell you, and then I'll tell you how we arrived at this conclusion, but I'll just tell you the punchline, and that is that this system exhibits, you'll see, extreme bistability in the sense that there are two solutions for how to get phosphate into the cell, particularly in this intermediate phosphate regime that I was talking about, and that is either using low-affinity transporters or using high-affinity transporters. And you'll see that this is an either-or decision. Okay. So the way in which we came upon this was by analyzing another phenotype that the Fo84 mutant had. And this was sensitivity to a toxic analog, arsenate. So it turns out that arsenate enters cells through phosphate transporters. This is true in essentially all organisms. And we use sensitivity to arsenate as a proxy for phosphate uptake. Okay, and so the observations here, which we had for a number of years and couldn't interpret, are the following, and now they actually make perfect sense. So the wild-type cells are arsenate sensitive, and this is because the transporters are present and cells uptake arsenate, and at certain amounts it kills the cell. Fo84 cells, lacking Fo84, are arsenate resistant. And again, this was a strange observation in the sense that how can the cells be arsenate resistant if they still have low affinity transporters? And at the time, we sort of hand-waved and said, well, maybe the cells are arsenate resistant if they lack Fo84, because the only way arsenate can get into the cell is through Fo84. And so you delete the gene, they can't bring in arsenate. And that accounts for the resistance. Okay, but the student persisted and did a couple of other experiments that blew that model out of the water. And that was to delete other genes. This was classic epistasis, to delete other genes in the Fo pathway that I told you about. Fo81, this is a CDK inhibitor, and Fo4, the transcription factor. And now the cells are arsenate sensitive again. Okay, so this model that arsenate comes in through Fo84 only, and that's why the cells are arsenate resistant, can't be right. And it turns out, so we got another clue as to what was going on when we did phosphate uptake, which essentially mirrored the results of this arsenate resistance sensitivity phenotype. And we did this to just make sure we weren't looking at some like bizarre artifact of arsenate, but it's not the case. So cells lacking Fo84 have a defect in phosphate uptake when grown in our normal laboratory conditions. But cells that are deleted for Fo81 and Fo84, or indeed Fo4 and Fo84, have no phosphate uptake defect. Okay? So the simple model that emerged from this analysis is that cells that constitutively activate the Fo pathway inhibit the low affinity transport. And that this is what accounts for these bizarre phenotypes. So we speculated that in the FO84 deletion strain, the reason it's arsenate resistant and has a phosphate uptake defect is because the strain has inactivated the low affinity phosphate transporters. Okay, and the reason that these strains, deletion of FO81 or FO4 in a background of this FO84 mutation, essentially alleviates the defect in phosphate uptake and restores arsenate sensitivity is because something downstream of FO4, perhaps FO4 itself, is required to inhibit the low affinity phosphate transporters. And so in this strain lacking FO4, FO84 is gone, but the low affinity transporters are still functional. Okay, and that's the model. And what I'm going to do is step you through the data that I think provides significant support for this idea. Okay, so the idea here again is in low phosphate, when the cells sense low concentrations of phosphate intracellularly, we know this activates the FO pathway. We also know that this leads to increased transcription of FO84, this high affinity phosphate transporter, and we postulate based on that weak arsenate data that I showed you on the previous slide, that activation of the FO pathway leads to inhibition of low affinity transport. Okay, and then in high phosphate, the FO pathway is off, so you get no expression of FO84. We've known this for a long time, and we would speculate that, not just speculate, we have data that the low affinity transport system under high phosphate conditions is operable, meaning if you measure bulk transport in yeast cells, the KM is consistent with the KM of the low affinity transporters, and if you delete the genes, the KM changes, in fact, to that of the high affinity system. And this is presumably because the cells starve for phosphate. Okay, so that's the model. I just told you that. And activation and repression do not have to have the same threshold. Absolutely. That's absolutely. And as I'll just tell you now that we know little mechanistically about the mechanism of repression of the low affinity system. It's not transcriptional. That's what's made this hard to study. Okay. Okay, so back to this issue of why, when you delete the high affinity transporter, do the cells turn the pathway on? Well, what we'd speculate is that any perturbation that leads to even transient decreases in intracellular phosphate will activate the FO pathway, and this leads to inhibition of low affinity transport. And inhibition of transport in the absence of FO84, this is going to cause further decreases in intracellular phosphate levels, which are going to lead to further activation of the FO pathway. So the idea here is that in the absence of FO84, when cells experience a decrease in intracellular phosphate levels, and I'm not saying at all where that's coming from at this point, but when cells experience a decrease in intracellular phosphate levels that activates the FO pathway, then this positive feedback loop will be engaged. And normally, this decrease in intracellular phosphate levels and activation of the FO pathway would not only lead to inhibition of low affinity transport, but activation of high affinity transport. But cells lacking the high affinity transporter, of course, can't activate transcription of this transporter. Yeah, so I'm going to get to that. Absolutely. Yes, we have some ideas. And I'll tell you what we've done to try to test this. Okay, so if this model's right, then we predict that in the strain lacking FO84, the FO pathway should be on, meaning the kinase should be inactive. And in the double mutant, FO84, FO4, or FO84, FO81, the FO pathway should be off. Okay, and I don't mean downstream of FO4, because obviously if you delete FO4, that can't transcribe any genes. That's not interesting. But I mean measuring the activity of the kinase. Okay, the kinase should be inactive in the double mutant and active in the single mutant. Okay, that's the prediction. So we can test this by monitoring the subcellular localization of FO4. Remember, I told you when it's phosphorylated, it's cytoplasmic, and unphosphorylated, it's concentrated in the nucleus. Okay? Now, there's a problem here because we need to monitor in a strain lacking Fo4. And we can do this using essentially a mutant form of Fo4 that we characterized previously, which we know is regulated appropriately. And this mutant lacks the DNA binding domain, and so we know that it can neither dimerize, so Fo4 is a dimer actually, and it also can't activate transcription because it can't bind to DNA, but its localization is regulated appropriately. So it contains all of the phosphorylation sites I told you about previously. And this truncated protein essentially serves as a measure of a readout of the kinase activity, the status of the kinase. So when the kinase is active, it's cytoplasmic, and when the kinase is inactive, it's concentrated in the nucleus. And we knew this previously. And so now we have a tool that we can use to monitor kinase activity or proxy for kinase activity in these two situations. And what we see is exactly what we expected based on that model I told you previously. Okay, so this is the reporter lacking the DNA binding domain. It's fused to GFP. And if we just focus on the second column here first, this is a strain that has a wild type copy of Fo4, but it's lacking Fo84. And in this case, I mean, this we essentially knew all along. In high phosphate conditions, I told you the Fo84 delete has this constitutive activation of the Fo pathway phenotype. Fo4 is localized to the nucleus in both high and in no phosphate. Okay, that's, we knew this would be the case. Now, the surprising and really obvious result here is what happens to this monitor of kinase activity when you delete Fo4 in a strain lacking Fo84. And you see now the kinase is active again. But the reporter is perfectly competent in this strain of being brought into the nucleus to enter the nucleus by phosphate starvation. And finally, here is another control. This is a mutant that lacks the kinase, lacks a subunit of the kinase, Fo80, and also lacks Fo4, and you can see it's constitutively localized to the nucleus. Okay, so this is exactly what we'd expect. Based on that model, the strain lacking Fo84 constitutively activates the Fo pathway, the kinase is inactive, Fo4 is localized to the nucleus. Deletion of Fo4 causes the reporter to be localized to the cytoplasm, presumably because it restores kinase activity, and it does so, we speculate, by allowing the cells to restore phosphate uptake. It blocks the downregulation of the low affinity system that would occur in cells that are constitutively activating the Fo pathway. Yeah, heterogeneous. Yeah, so the reason I don't know in this particular experiment why we get some heterogeneity, I'll tell you one possibility. This plasmid is it's a centromere-based plasmid, but present in fluctuating numbers of copies per cell. This does not have a perfect send sequence, and so as a consequence, the copy number is not maintained perfectly. So some of those could be the result of differences in copy number. Now, that may not be the case because I wouldn't expect it to be so strain specific. Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on there. Okay, so. This led us to conclude that if the low affinity transporter is not repressed, then the Fo84 strain, we would speculate, it wouldn't starve for phosphate and it wouldn't turn on the Fo pathway. That's what the data with that reporter suggests. And this implies that Fo84 doesn't make a significant contribution to phosphate uptake in high phosphate conditions, that it's mediated primarily through this low affinity system. But then again, if this is true, it still begs the question of what gets the whole feedback loop started. Why does the Fo84 deletion turn on the Fo pathway to begin with? I mean, it's easy to see based on this simple feedback model here why once something activates the faux pathway. This positive feedback loop is going to be engaged in the faux84 deletion strain, and the cells will essentially get stuck in the on state. Okay, and so the idea, or one idea, and there certainly are others, is that perhaps the faux84 deletion strain at some time in its history was transiently starved for phosphate. And by history, I mean we take cells out of the freezer, we plate them on a plate, an auger plate, and colonies grow up, and we colony purify from that, and you know, have a patch of cells, but a patch of cells sitting on an auger plate, where the auger plate is phosphate replete. But the idea we had was that perhaps on a plate, you know, the cells are concentrated in a small space, and perhaps these cells are, this condition leads to transient starvation for phosphate. Okay, so that was the idea, as crazy as it sounds, and the predictions are that if our model's right, the faux84 deletion strain, and if what I told you is right, the faux84 deletion strain should be able to exist with this pathway turned off. And then we would, if this is true, faux84 might be important for buffering against transient decreases in extracellular phosphate. And furthermore, we would expect that the phosphate uptake defect that's observed in a faux84 deletion strain should be dependent on the growth conditions, which will influence whether the low affinity system is downregulated or not. And so we did two experiments that I'm going to show you. We grew cells lacking faux84 but containing this faux4 GFP reporter. So now this is fully functional faux4, replacing the wild type copy. And we grow them for a prolonged period of time in high phosphate. Okay, and if my model regarding transient phosphate starvation on a plate is correct, we'd predict that faux4 will now be cytoplasmic in cells lacking faux84 because they've had enough time essentially to inactivate the faux pathway. And this is indeed what we see. So the system exhibits, you'll see, tremendous hysteresis. Here, we take them from a plate and we grow them 24 hours in high phosphate conditions in liquid. Yep, absolutely. Okay, and so then I'll show you an experiment where what we did after doing that, after growing for a prolonged period of time in high phosphate, is to transiently deprive the cells of phosphate and then add back phosphate and ask whether the cells are able to reestablish repression of the phosphate pathway. And we know wild-type cells do this very rapidly. And we predicted that faux84 cells would exhibit hysteresis and still have faux4 in the nucleus. Okay, and finally, I'll show you some phosphate uptake experiments that confirm, that provide support for the model I've been proposing. So we took cells lacking faux84, grown in high or no phosphate, and we predicted that the phosphate uptake rate would be dependent on faux4, right, the presence of faux4, because in the faux84 deletion strain, we would anticipate that these cells will repress low affinity phosphate, phosphate transport in a faux4 dependent manner, and furthermore, we predict if these things are true above, that the phosphate uptake should be dependent on the prior growth conditions. And I'll show you it is dramatically. Okay, so first this growing the faux84 deletion strain with this reporter and looking at what happens. So that's what's shown here. So the reporter here is again on a plasmid, but this time a stable low copy plasmid in a strain, all of them, they lack faux4. So this provides the functional copy of faux4. And I think the most important thing is shown here. When we grow the faux84 deletion strain in high phosphate for 20 hours, now faux4 is localized to the cytoplasm. So this strain lacking faux84 can exist with a faux pathway turned off. And now if we transiently starve the cells for phosphate and then monitor what happens in the faux84 deletion strain or in wild-type cells, you see faux4 becomes concentrated in the nucleus in many of the cells here in both wild type and 44 deletion strain. When we add back phosphate, the wild type cells rapidly export Fo4 from the nucleus. We've known this for a long time, but cells lacking Fo84 do not. And indeed, we can go many, many hours after adding phosphate back, and Fo4 remains in the nucleus in a significant fraction of the cells. So again, what accounts for the heterogeneity here? We don't really know. The experiment should certainly be done with an integrated copy of the Fo4 GFP fusion. Okay, so then the phosphate uptake, and this really was a striking result. So here we're monitoring uptake of the Fo84 deletion, where the strains were grown previously in high phosphate conditions for 24 hours, like I told you about previously. So these are conditions that turn off the Fo pathway in the Fo84 deletion strain. So they should not repress low affinity uptake. And indeed, it turns out the cells uptake phosphate at a rate that's only twofold different from wild type cells. And this is in striking contrast to what happens if you, instead of growing the Fo84 deletion strain for a long time in high phosphate, you starve them, the cells, for 2 hours prior to doing phosphate uptake assays. You see there's a dramatic reduction in phosphate uptake. And again, the idea here is that in the Fo84 deletion strain, starve for phosphate, the cells activate the Fo pathway, repress low affinity transport, and they essentially can't get any phosphate into the cell.
Are you able to make
the phosphate low affinity transport and the repression? Yeah, so we have done some experiments measuring the concentration of the low affinity transporters. It's not really concentration, measuring abundance at the plasma membrane. That's what we're doing. And there are only modest changes in abundance at the plasma membrane, and this is what has made studying the mechanism of downregulation challenging. I mean, presumably, there could be a lot of reasons. I mean, there are many ways in which those transporters could be regulated. And we now have some good candidates from a genetic screen, but it's been a challenging problem. And so here the control now, you see when you delete Fo4, Fo84 deletion strain, the phosphate uptake properties now become relatively insensitive to the prior growth conditions. Again, we'd speculate because the cells have low affinity transporters and are perfectly capable of uptaking phosphate from the environment. Okay, so we think, well, so the data strongly indicates that the strain lacking Fo84 exhibits dramatic hysteresis. It essentially becomes stuck in this on state, Fo pathway on, if it's transiently starved. And so this implies that in wild type cells, Fo84 might be important for getting out of this state where the Fo pathway is on. And again, we think that all that's going on is the Fo pathway both activates transcription of Fo84 and inhibits the activity of the low affinity transporters. And so what we think is happening in wild type cells, I told you, in high concentrations of intracellular phosphate, this turns off the Fo pathway and the cells use low affinity transporters to get phosphate into the cell, because they don't have, the high affinity one is not actively transcribed. But as extracellular phosphate decreases, what'll happen is that the low affinity transporters, which have a Km in the hundreds of micromolar range, they will at some point no longer be able to keep up with cellular needs, right? It will exceed the rate at which cells can uptake phosphate from the environment. And under these conditions, at some point, intracellular phosphate levels will decrease, at least transiently. This will activate the Fo pathway, which will activate expression of Fo84, the high affinity transporter, and lead to inhibition of low affinity transport. So if this model's right, we would predict that transcription of Fo84 might exhibit this bistability. And this is exactly what we see in wild-type cells when we use a single-cell reporter to monitor transcription of the Fo84 gene. And this here is monitored by flow cytometry, and just the bottom panel here is a phosphate titration. So we've grown cells in different concentrations of phosphate and then essentially analyzed them by flow cytometry at, I think, 4 hours after transfer from high phosphate to each of these phosphate conditions. And what you can see is that we get this bimodal distribution. And I'll tell you that we have started now to characterize the properties of these two populations here. So this population has higher levels of the high affinity FOAD4 transporter, and we'd speculate that this population would have higher levels of the low affinity transporter. I'll tell you what small amount we know from experiments in which we've sorted the two populations and then analyzed the inner conversion, the rate of inner conversion between this high FOAD4 and lower FOAD4 state, and also the properties of the signaling pathway. Okay, so first, in a sorting experiment, and this was a preliminary experiment done by a student in my group, what he did is to sort the population into these two portions, one that has, I'll call FOAD4 on, it's more on, and another that has less FOAD4 expression, and then re-inoculate the cells into either no phosphate, these intermediate concentrations of phosphate, or high phosphate conditions. And what you can see clearly over here, when we take the low FOAD4 expressors and inoculate them back into intermediate phosphate conditions, that's where the cells came from, or into high phosphate conditions, the cells remain with FOAD4 in this lower expression state, but in response to phosphate starvation, the cells are perfectly capable of activating expression of FOAD4. Similarly, if we take the FOAD4 on peak and re-inoculate into no phosphate or high phosphate, we don't have the intermediate sample here, I have no idea what happened, but at any rate, the majority of the population, even after 20 hours, remains in this FOAD4 on state, even when we put the cells back in high phosphate. So these are wild type cells put back in high phosphate conditions. And we don't really know, this small amount of contamination from the lower FOAD4 expressing cells, I have no idea whether this is essentially a problem with the initial sort, because the experiment wasn't, the populations weren't analyzed immediately after sorting for a number of technical reasons, or whether this indeed represents conversion from the on state to what I'm calling the off state. But the one thing to say is, even if this does represent inner conversion, the two states, the rate of inner conversion must be very slow, because this is 20 hours after we've re-inoculated. Without reporter? Oh, sorry, yeah. Oh, where on this peak would they sit? Right about here, about 100. I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. Yes, as far as we know, just their affinity. I mean, their sequence, the sequence is very different. No, so that's a good question. So if we monitor essentially the rate of transport velocity, the velocity that can be achieved with the low and high affinity transporters, very similar. That's right, they differ by less than a factor of 2. So if you compare high, just wild type cells, high phosphate or no phosphate, where we sort of know what's going on, there the difference in velocity is, yeah, it's... Right. Right, so why bother turn it off? Okay, so, I think that's, I certainly don't have an answer to that, but one idea is that when FOAD4 is produced under starvation conditions, it accounts for a significant fraction of, you know, flux through the secretory pathway and a significant amount of protein on the plasma membrane. But you're right. I mean, you know, do I really... Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I'll give you one other idea is that, you know, it's not advantageous to have the transporter, the high affinity transporter. Maybe it's more efficient at uptake of arsenate, for example. And the cells, you know, live in an environment where they encounter toxic substances, and this is the reason they downregulate high affinity transport. I mean, I think those are... Yeah, why bother to down-regulate low affinity transport? Yeah. The transporters per se, no, are not ATP dependent. They're dependent on the proton gradient across the plasma membrane, which is itself ATP dependent. Yes, it does transport some other things, yes. Some of those have broader specificity than the high affinity transporter, although, you know, there hasn't been a huge amount of work characterizing that. Yeah, Yes. High affinity, yes. Low affinity, no. It's possible. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. Yeah. I think average conditions really are this intermediate phosphate. As needed. Yes. Yeah, sure. Yes. Yeah. It is, but... Yes, you want more phosphate, and there's no reason to believe that, unlike zinc, phosphate, we have no reason to believe is toxic in excess. Like, the capacity of the vacuole is huge. So, yeah, it's hard to understand. And I'll also say that, so the zinc system, which we've also done some work on, has the exact same kind of set up with high affinity and low affinity transporters, and we don't see this, you know, population splitting into two peaks like this. That's possible. It's possible. Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. That could be.
You don't want to eat away their binding target because they're going to get stuck.
Yeah. And they all have these low and high affinity. This is like, I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, originally we didn't bother looking for any low affinity because it was like, what's FO84? It's good enough. But. Yeah, so low affinity is FO84 is on the order of 5 to 10 micromolar. High affinity is hundreds of micromolar depending on which transporter you're measuring. Well, so yeah, it's in right in that range. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll just tell you, but I won't show you.
You're not working in the situation.
Yeah.
Why not just putting everything high chemistry on the side?
Right.
Why do you need lower chemistry for?
Right, near the con. Sure, sure. Right.
But the mother, I think, not the one you want, low thing, because you want to be able to regulate, you want low uptake and not noisy uptake. You don't want to put low amounts of high efficacy transport, that's better.
Right, in the high phosphate situation, yeah. Yeah, you mean if you use high affinity and high phosphate? Huh. Yeah, this is, it's a really interesting issue. I mean, so the other thing I should say that we do know is that when we sort these two populations, so we generated a strain that also had a reporter, the FO4 GFP reporter in it, and a marker for the nucleus, constitutively nuclear protein, and those observations are absolutely clear. This peak that I'm calling FO84 on, which has higher levels of FO84 than the other peak, FO4 is concentrated in the nucleus, and in this lower, the peak with lower levels of FO84 expression, the cells with lower levels of FO84 expression, FO4 is localized to the cytoplasm. So there really is a clear, I mean, exactly as you'd expect from, you know, it reflects the FO84 expression. The thing we haven't done that really needs to be done is to characterize the transport properties of the two populations. I mean, the model makes a very clear prediction that this off-peak should use low-affinity transport. Yeah. Okay, so I've said this. Right, so what we think is going on is that feedback from repression of the low affinity transport by this FO pathway, we'd speculate, is what's contributing to the bistability in FO84 induction. And clearly this is something that we have to test, but it's hard to do unless we can figure out mechanistically how this feedback works, because, I mean, the experiment that we'd like to do is interfere with the feedback and then examine whether there still exists bistability in FO84 induction. Okay, and so some of these things we've talked about, you know, why do the cells bother to do this? Is the bistability advantageous? I mean, one thing we are going to do to try to deal with that, or try to address that, is to sort the two populations and then measure growth rates in different phosphate concentrations. Yep. No, they don't secrete phosphatase. So I didn't emphasize this, but under these conditions, what we're calling intermediate, the phosphatase expression is really low. So the pathway is activated, but FO4 is phosphorylated on site 6, and this form doesn't efficiently activate transcription of FO5. We know that from other work. So under these conditions, yeah, the pathway is not fully activated, but FO4 is concentrated in the nucleus. Okay, and so the other thing that we're very interested in, I mean, just like Michael was talking about this morning, is what's generating the split in the population. I mean, what populates these two states? I mean, they're essentially two solutions to the problem the cell has of getting phosphate inside in this intermediate phosphate regime. You either use the high affinity system or the low affinity system, and we want to know, this is a hard issue, but what generates the split in the population, and you know, whether stochastic fluctuations in expression of FO84 or the low affinity transporters or something else in the pathway is contributing to the split. That's something we'd very much like to know about. Okay, in 5 minutes, I can tell you what we know about buffering, because I've already said a bunch about this, that polyphosphate stored in the vacuole, when the cells have plenty of phosphate, they use enzymes and transporters to bring phosphate in, and they have enzymes that are involved in the synthesis of this polymer of inorganic phosphate. They also have enzymes that are involved in the breakdown of polyphosphate that are activated in response to starvation. And so we were really interested in assessing whether this is indeed used by the cells as a buffer that's mobilized in response to phosphate starvation, and which might be able to buffer intracellular inorganic phosphate levels from changes in the environment. Okay, and the way we got into this is this experiment here, where we just monitor in a time course, so this is a population analysis, looking at expression of FO5 and FO84 as a function of time after transfer of cells to no phosphate, so starvation conditions. Very simple experiment. And we monitor localization of FO4. There should be an axis here, but there's not. So just percent of cells in the population having certain threshold ratio of nuclear to cytoplasmic FO4, and then expression of FO5 and FO84. So very rapidly after transfer to no phosphate conditions, FO4 in the dashed line goes into the nucleus, and shortly thereafter, or in parallel with FO4 entry into the nucleus, we observe production of FO84 transcript. And what you can see is there's a striking delay in the induction of FO5. Dephosphorylated. Yes, that is exactly what we think is happening. Yes, absolutely. So that's a hard experiment to do, to assess FO4 phosphorylation across as a time in this time course. That's something we want to do. It needs to be done by a better method than we've been using, which is phosphopeptide specific antibodies. It's just a technical issue. That is exactly what we think is happening. FO5 is the phosphatase, secreted phosphatase. Yes, transcribed by FO4. They're both transcribed by FO4. That's right. That's right. And yes, so that's exactly what we think is going on. When you transfer cells to no phosphate, they essentially transition through intracellularly this intermediate phosphate regime. That's exactly what we think is going on. So in the time scale that mirrors induction of FO5, we see loss usage of polyphosphate from internal stores. And this led us to speculate that perhaps the utilization of polyphosphate maintains intracellular levels of phosphate at a concentration that are high enough to keep the kinase active enough to repress FO5 transcription but allow activation of FO84. So that's the idea, and if this model's true, if we abolish the polyphosphate buffer, we should affect the kinetics of FO5 induction. And that's exactly what we see. So here are three mutations, either accumulation or usage of polyphosphate, and now the kinetics of induction of the two genes are very similar. Okay. Furthermore, So we were really interested in this idea that polyphosphate mobilization under conditions of starvation might buffer the cells from, say, transient decreases in extracellular phosphate. And so we did an experiment that's diagrammed here, where we took cells grown in high phosphate and then deprived them transiently for 10, 30, 60, or 120 minutes for phosphate. So just washed it away. And then after the times indicated, we added phosphate back to high phosphate levels and then monitored expression of Fo5 and Fo84 in wild type or cells lacking polyphosphate by flow cytometry. So these are all transcriptional reporters. In this case, it's YFP. And so what you see for Fo5 is that transient starvation for 10 or 30 minutes causes little induction of Fo5 expression, and this contrasts with Fo84, which 30 minutes causes significant induction of the reporter gene. Now when we delete the polyphosphate buffer with any of a number of mutations, you see you affect Fo5 induction. Now Fo5 is turned on in response to these shorter duration starvation for phosphate. So we think that polyphosphate is acting as a phosphate buffer that feeds internal phosphate levels. So there's some concentration in the cytoplasm, and then a large capacity that comes from the buffer, what we speculate is a buffer in the form of polyphosphate in the yeast vacuole. And in wild-type cells, what we think is going on is that the cells, when the cells are transferred from high to no phosphate, internal phosphate levels are initially high, and they drop to a point where they cross what is presumably the threshold for Fo84 induction. So this is a level of kinase activity where this site 6 is still phosphorylated. We know Fo84 is turned on. And at some point, this triggers mobilization of these presumably decreases in internal phosphate levels trigger mobilization of this buffer, which sustains intracellular phosphate levels for some period of time simply by producing, liberating inorganic phosphate. And only after the buffer is depleted, I showed you, does Fo5 induce. And so there's a huge difference in the kinetics, a large difference between Fo84 and Fo5 induction. Now, when we delete the polyphosphate buffer, of course, there's nothing to sustain intracellular phosphate levels. Now we see similar kinetics of induction for the two genes. Okay, so finally, I just want to point out the people in my lab who did all of the work. This sort of story about the bistability that's very much work in progress was done by two students, Jonathan Razor and Brian Marglin, with help from a postdoc, Dennis Wyckoff. The buffering is the work of Melissa Thomas, a postdoc, and finally Mike Springer, a former student in my lab, really had a lot of intellectual input into many of these ideas. So thanks. I'll stop.
Yeah,
so that's really a good question. The short answer is no. We have two new candidates, though, I'll tell you. So the genetics has been uninformative in the sense that what I showed you, that little pathway, the genetic schematic, is what came from classical genetic studies with Fo84 at the top of this pathway. And so we initially tested whether Fo84 was involved in sensing. And there are a number of experiments that strongly suggest that protein's not involved in the actual sensing. And that, moreover, as I said, the sensing's done intracellularly. So we have two new candidates that both that came from a screen of the yeast deletion collection looking for mutants that have quantitative defects in the kinetics of Fo5 induction. And both of them encode enzymes that are involved in essentially the conversion of AMP to ADP, adenosine kinase and adenylate kinase. So the exciting thing about them is that one of them interacts with Fo85, the kinase, physically, and has, uses inorganic phosphate as an allosteric regulator of its activity. So that's probably the best candidate we have for the intracellular phosphate sensor. It's also possible that the CDK inhibitor, FO81, about which I said little, actually directly senses phosphate. And the reason that is an appealing model is that the N-terminal 150 amino acids has similarity to a huge number of inorganic phosphate transporters in yeast and human cells. Yeah? So the six I diagrammed on the slide all have very similar architecture to what I just described, meaning high affinity, low affinity transport, this transcriptional, post-translational regulation, buffer, and that's basically it. No. So those, yeah, that's, and I didn't say, but yes, so the nutrients are all maintained separately. Those six, now others are not, but those six are. Yes, so starvation for one doesn't influence the other. So for example, you starve for any of those, it doesn't influence the ability to respond to phosphate. Yeah. Not those six. So others, there certainly is. In the cases where there are alternative sources, like carbon and nitrogen, there are. There absolutely are. Is crosstalk, yes, mediated in part by the TOR pathway in yeast. Yeah. And protein kinase A, for example. Yeah. Like directly, you mean? Probably not. The energetics of, you mean non-catalyzed? Probably not. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.